residents of the United States were distributed principally as follows. Italy, 1,257,000. Germany, 990,000. Canada, 953,000. United Kingdom, 833,000. Poland, 748,000. In 2000, the distribution was very different. Mexico, 7,841,000. China, 1,391,000. Philippines, 1,222,000. India, 1,007,000. Cuba, 952,000. With these demographic shifts have come enormous cultural transformations as well. Although white Protestants, especially male, continue to wield considerable influence all over America, with disproportionate representation in the U.S. Congress, for example, their dominance has waned in recent years. For example, white Protestants are today disproportionately underrepresented at our institutions of higher learning. A 2014 Pew Research Center study found that around 46% of Americans were Protestant, but at Harvard University, named after Puritan pastor John Harvard, only 20% of the class of 2017 described themselves as Protestant. Although most U.S. Supreme Court justices since 1789 have been white Protestants, after Justice John Paul Stevens retired in 2010, the court became entirely comprised of Catholics and Jews, and remained so until the 2017 appointment of Neil Gorsuch, who was raised Catholic, but who now worships with an Episcopal congregation. Perhaps most strikingly, on the day of this writing, Billboard's top 10 musical artists included only one singer and one duo of white Protestant descent, Taylor Swift and 21 Pilots. This brings us back to the heart of today's tribal politics, the fact that every group in America today feels threatened, whatever the reality. Although it may seem preposterous given the persistence of racism in the United States, and the fact that non-whites continue to be underrepresented at the highest levels of many fields, many white Americans now feel the country is culturally and socially dominated by blacks and other minorities. They experience their world as being swallowed up by a popular culture that equates coolness with multiculturalism and lionizes hip-hop music and movies like Moonlight about a gay black man. Needless to say, many on the left deride this view, pointing out that Hollywood is still very male and very white. The hashtag #OscarsSoWhite went viral during the 2016 Academy Awards season, and decrying the fact that Adele, instead of Beyoncé, won Album of the Year at the 2017 Grammys. Nevertheless, from the point of view of many white Americans, ones who think the world of Mad Men wasn't necessarily all that bad, they've lost their cultural primacy. Now, it seems, everything they see, TV programming, commercials, pop music, ads on the subway, is influenced and increasingly flavored by minority culture. America's national identity is no longer exclusively defined by WASPs, nor by whites more generally, nor by any of America's countless other ethnic subgroups. The 97% white population of Kennebunkport, Maine, is of course part of American identity and culture, but so are Cuban Americans in Miami's Little Havana, and Iranian Americans in LA's Little Persia. Americanness embraces everyone born in this country, from the children of Jamaican immigrants to the grandchildren of Vietnamese immigrants to the great-great-grandchildren of Jewish immigrants, from Mayflower descendants to the descendants of slaves. American society remains shot through with racism, and things may be getting worse, not better. A supergroup is not a perfect group. It is not post-racial. It can be full of violence and inequality. But no one can doubt that Barack Obama, Oprah Winfrey, and Derek Jeter are American. Indeed, they are all symbols, faces of America. What it means to be American is not the preserve of any particular racial, ethnic, or religious subgroup. In a 1990 speech, Ronald Reagan gave eloquent expression to the extraordinary expansiveness of being American and how that makes the United States different from other countries. You can go live in France, but you can't become a Frenchman. You can go to live in Germany or Italy, but you can't become a German, an Italian. But anyone from any corner of the world can come to live in the United States and become an American. If we take this crowd, and if we could go through and ask the heritage, the background of every family represented here, we would probably come up with the names of every country on earth, every corner of the world, and every race. Here is the one spot on earth where we have the brotherhood of man. By the 21st century, however imperfectly and haltingly, the United States of America had become a supergroup, the only one among all the world's great powers. Foreign policy implications. Precisely because it's so unusual, America's status as a supergroup has led us astray when it comes to assessing the tribal politics of other nations. We forget how unusual it is to have both an extremely diverse, multi-ethnic population and a strong, overarching national identity capable of binding the people together. Libya, Syria, and Iraq are all, like the United States, post-colonial, multi-ethnic nations, but none of them has a national identity anywhere close to as strong as ours. In countries like these, it can be a catastrophic mistake to imagine that through democratic elections, people will suddenly rally around a national identity and overcome their pre-existing ethnic, religious, sectarian, and tribal divides. On the contrary, in sharply divided societies, democracy often galvanizes group conflict, with political movements and parties coalescing around these more primal identities. America has made this mistake over and over again. Thus, American exceptionalism, in its different facets, both at its ugliest and most inspiring, lies at the root of our obliviousness to the tribal identities that matter most intensely to people abroad. Sometimes racism blinds us, but most fundamentally, we tend to assume that other nations can handle diversity as we have, and that a strong national identity will overcome more primal group divisions. This mentality suffers from two fatal flaws. First, it's a naive view of the world. After a U.S.-led coalition toppled Colonel Gaddafi in 2011, President Obama declared, "One thing is clear, the future of Libya is now in the hands of the Libyan people. It will be Libyans who build their new nation." But the Libyan people hail from some 140 different tribes, and they did not come together to build their new nation. On the contrary, the country began a slow descent into fragmentation and eventually a bloody civil war. As Obama would later say, "The degree of tribal division in Libya was greater than our analysts had expected." In 2016, the top U.S. general in Africa declared Libya a failed state, and it is now a hotbed of radicalism. Obama himself has said that failing to plan for the day after in Libya was probably the worst mistake of his presidency. If we are to get things right in our foreign policy, we need to be much more alert to the destructive potential of the group instinct abroad. Second, it's a naive view of ourselves. The belief that other countries can handle diversity as well as America assumes that we can handle our own diversity. But the United States is not immune to the destructive forces of political tribalism, the forces that have repeatedly torn other nations apart and turned our foreign interventions into catastrophes. Chapter 2. Vietnam. Vietnam is too close to China, too far from heaven. Vietnamese proverb. We will drive the Americans into the sea. Pham Van Dong, North Vietnamese premier. In Henry Kissinger's words, no war since the Civil War has seared the national consciousness like Vietnam. Even as the war was unfolding, Hans Morgenthau, one of the leading international relations experts of the 20th century, wrote, "We are humiliated in the eyes of the world. What is worse and graver is that we humiliate ourselves in our own eyes because we betray the moral principles, the ideals on which this country was founded." Arguably the first war lost in American history, the Vietnam War was, to quote George McGovern, an utter, unmitigated disaster. 50 years later, the question remains, how did superpower America, with its formidable military, lose to what Lyndon B. Johnson called a piddling, pissant little country, or actually, half that country? It's by now widely recognized that the decision-makers in Washington, D.C., David Halberstam's The Best and the Brightest, overlooked the potency of Vietnamese nationalism, instead interpreting events through the Cold War lens of a worldwide struggle between freedom and communism. As Thomas Friedman puts it, the United States failed to understand that the core political drama of Vietnam was an indigenous nationalist struggle against colonial rule, not the embrace of global communism, the interpretation we imposed on it. But that's still not the complete picture. To this day, we don't fully understand what we got so badly wrong in Vietnam. Driving and shaping Vietnamese nationalism was a millennia-old ethnic conflict going back far longer than resentment against the West. The core reason we lost in Vietnam is that we failed to see the ethnic dimension of Vietnamese nationalism. But to understand this phenomenon, we need to understand ethnicity itself, its basis, its internal logic, and the source of its primal appeal, which goes to the heart of political tribalism. The tribal instinct and ethnicity. In a recent study, children between the ages of 4 and 6 were randomly assigned to a red or blue group and asked to put on a t-shirt of the corresponding color. They were then shown edited computer images of other children, half of whom appeared to be wearing red t-shirts, the other half blue, and asked about their reactions to these children. Even though they knew absolutely nothing about the children in the photos, the subjects consistently reported that they liked children of their own group better, allocated more resources to them, and displayed strong unconscious preferences for in-group members. In addition, when told stories about the children in the photos, these boys and girls exhibited systematic memory distortion, tending to remember positive actions of in-group members and negative actions of out-group members. Without any supporting social information whatsoever, the researchers concluded the children's perception of other kids was pervasively distorted by mere membership in a social group, a finding with disturbing implications. The impulse to form group identities and favor in-group members has a neurological basis. Using functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, scientists have scanned people's brains while conducting experiments similar to the one just described. Their findings, as one writer puts it, suggest that group identification is both innate and almost immediate. In social psychologist J. Van Bavel's recent experiments, participants randomly assigned to different groups were placed under an fMRI and shown photos of supposed rivals and teammates. When participants saw members of their own team, certain sections of the brain, the amygdala, fusiform gyri, orbitofrontal cortex, and dorsal striatum, tended to light up. These areas of the brain are thought to be associated with distinguishing between relevant and irrelevant stimuli and with perceptions of value. What this suggests is that our brains are hardwired to identify, value, and individualize in-group members, while out-group members are processed as interchangeable members of a general social category, making it easier to negatively stereotype them. Even more striking, seeing other members of our in-group prosper seems to activate our reward centers, generating emotional satisfaction even if we receive no benefit ourselves. The neurological processes of in-group recognition and favoritism start extremely early. Newborns shown images of people's faces do not respond differently based on race. But as early as 3 months later, in Yale psychologist Paul Bloom's words, Caucasian babies prefer to look at Caucasian faces as opposed to African or Chinese faces. Ethiopian babies prefer to look at Ethiopian faces rather than Caucasian faces. Chinese babies prefer to look at Chinese faces rather than Caucasian or African faces. While we can take comfort in the fact that humans aren't born racists, it's unnerving to realize that racial preferences develop so early. Racial in-group empathy can operate neurologically even when we don't realize or acknowledge it. When scientists showed Caucasian and Chinese college students images of a person being pricked by a large needle, the students' reported pain evaluations showed no racial disparities, but fMRIs taken at the same time showed significantly increased activity in the subject's ACC supplementary motor cortex, the area of the brain most associated with empathy for pain, when they were viewing people of their own race being injured. Perhaps most troubling, recent studies by Mina Chikara, the director of the Harvard Intergroup Neuroscience Lab, show that under certain circumstances, our brain's reward centers will activate when we see members of an out-group failing or suffering a misfortune. Normally, Chikara stresses, very few people actually go out of their way to harm the out-group. But when one group fears or envies another, when, for example, there is a long history of rivalry and not liking each other, it seems that Schadenfreude has a neurological basis. Group members will take sadistic pleasure in the pain of their perceived rivals. Humans aren't just a little tribal. We're very tribal, and it distorts the way we think and feel. But not all group identities are equally potent. Some have a much stronger grip than others and are more politically galvanizing. Very few people have ever given their lives for the American Podiatry Association. One of the most powerful forms of group identity, and the focal point of political tribalism and violence all over the world today, is ethnicity. The key to ethnic identity is that it's built around the idea of shared blood. In political scientist Donald Horowitz's words, ethnicity is a sense of belonging to a people that is experienced as a form of greatly extended kinship. For most human beings, the family is primal, the ur-group, and ethnicity taps into those primal feelings. The ethnic tie, as Horowitz puts it, is simultaneously suffused with overtones of familial duty and laden with depths of familial emotion. Mixed together with the idea of shared blood is a sense of a shared heritage and history, a common culture, and a common language, all typically viewed as passed down from parent to child. It's easy to scoff at myths of common ancestry. Little or no historical evidence supports the claim that today's 1 billion Han Chinese all descend from the Yellow Emperor, a legendary figure who supposedly reigned 5,000 years ago. The same is true of the claim that Jews all share the common forefather Jacob, or that the Yoruba all descend from the Emperor Oduduwa. But beliefs in shared blood are no less powerful for being mythic. Whether biologically based, as primordialists believe, or constructed by elites, culture, and power seekers, as instrumentalists believe, the experience of ethnic identification exists everywhere human beings do. It is one of the most combustible sources of political mobilization, and it is at its strongest when one group feels threatened, in danger of being extinguished, by another. Vietnamese identity. Like China, Vietnam is a quintessentially ethnic nation, rooted in a form of identity by blood. The vast majority of the population are ethnic Vietnamese, who also give the country its name and language. At the same time, Vietnam's national identity is practically defined in opposition to a Chinese enemy. China, of course, dwarfs Vietnam. In terms of size, China is roughly to Vietnam what the United States is to Ecuador. The two countries are also contiguous. If you look at a map, China looks vaguely like a 500-pound genie sitting on top of a tiny tilted lamp, which is Vietnam. Because of its looming proximity and size, China is not just an enemy to Vietnam, but a constant threat to its very survival. In 111 BC, China conquered the Viet people, incorporated Nam Viet, which in Chinese translates to Land of the Southern Barbarians, into the Chinese Empire, and for the next 1,000 years ruled it as a province of China. Under Chinese rule, the Vietnamese adopted much of Chinese culture, including Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism, with its imperial examination system and Mandarin bureaucracy. But the Vietnamese refused to become Chinese. On the contrary, they became all the more intensely ethnocentric. Although Chinese was the official language during Chinese rule, widely used among the elite, the Vietnamese preserved their own language along with memories of pre-Chinese civilization. They never lost their veneration for local heroes who resisted the Chinese. Even after Vietnam won independence from China in 938, it remained under Chinese domination, paying tribute to the Chinese emperor for another millennium. During this period, China repeatedly invaded Vietnam, but against all odds, China's forces were repelled over and over again. Tales of Vietnamese bravery and David versus Goliath ingenuity in beating back Chinese invaders lie at the heart of Vietnamese lore. Contemporary Vietnamese national identity is also, in part, a 20th century construction. In the 1920s, during French colonial rule, a group of young Vietnamese intellectuals emerged, calling for a new Vietnam free of colonial domination and the weight of the past. These intellectuals not only opposed the French, they zeroed in on China as well. Influential nationalists reminded the Vietnamese of their ancient struggle against China, resurrecting legendary figures like the Trung sisters, who in AD 40 freed Vietnamese lands from Chinese occupation, ultimately losing their lives, and supposedly their heads. The nationalists also attacked Confucianism as a suffocating tradition that stifled individual liberty and thought. According to historian Christopher Gosha, the nationalists' message was simple. Individual men and women had stood up in the past to resist 1,000 years of Chinese occupation. They could do it again. Mythic or not, every Vietnamese child learns of the heroic exploits of their forerunners, who are always fighting the same enemy, China. Indeed, the protracted fight against Chinese domination has been central in generating a sense of kinship and ethnic nationalism among the Vietnamese. As Vietnamese historian Tran Khan writes, the struggle for the survival of the Viet people against the Chinese enhanced the community spirit of the Viet people. They felt that they were brothers and sisters with common ancestors and did their utmost to safeguard their culture and race. Yet, astonishingly, U.S. foreign policymakers during the Cold War were so oblivious to Vietnamese history that they thought Vietnam was China's pawn, merely a stalking horse for Beijing in Southeast Asia. This was a group-blind mistake of colossal proportions. In 1995, Robert McNamara, who was Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War, met his former counterpart, the Foreign Minister of North Vietnam. "Mr. McNamara," he recalls his former enemy saying, "you must never have read a history book. If you had, you'd know we weren't pawns of the Chinese. Don't you understand that we have been fighting the Chinese for 1,000 years? We were fighting for our independence, and we would fight to the last man, and no amount of bombing, no amount of U.S. pressure would ever have stopped us." Cold War America saw North Vietnam's revolutionary leader Ho Chi Minh as a puppet of China. Again, this was a staggering mistake. As a child, Ho too had been raised on tales of Vietnamese heroes expelling hated Chinese oppressors. He had spent at least 13 months in Chinese prisons, sometimes in solitary confinement, and often forced to walk 25 to 30 miles in leg irons. Ho is often described as soft-spoken and has been compared to Gandhi. But lest it be thought that Ho was above anti-Chinese animus, after World War II, when one of his underlings suggested turning to China to fend off the French, Ho barked, "You fools! Don't you remember your history? The last time the Chinese came, they stayed 1,000 years. I prefer to sniff French shit for 5 years than eat Chinese shit for the rest of my life." Ho was also undoubtedly a Marxist. But if we had understood the Vietnamese people's deep distrust of the Chinese, is it possible that when Ho wrote to President Truman pleading for support in Vietnam's struggle against the French, a different strategy might have been open? Ho repeatedly likened Vietnam's fight for independence to America's. He even quoted the U.S. Declaration of Independence in Vietnam's own Declaration of Independence. An OSS report from the Truman era, which would remain classified for many years, described Ho as saying that, although he formerly favored communist ideals, he now realized that such ideals were impracticable for his country. Could we have supported Ho against the French, capitalizing on Vietnam's historical hostility toward China to keep the Vietnamese within our sphere of influence? We'll never know. Somehow, we never saw or took seriously the enmity between Vietnam and China. 30 years after the Vietnam War, former South Vietnam Premier Nguyen Cao Ky wrote, "To many Americans in Vietnam, we were just vaguely Chinese. We are not. We are Vietnamese. The Americans did not realize that we, almost alone in Asia, defeated China. When the Viets, as we were then called, beat the soldiers of the Tang Dynasty, and a century later defeated the troops of the Song Dynasty." Not only did we miss the animosity between Vietnam and China, We also missed an additional ethnic dimension, internal to Vietnam, which doomed us from the beginning in the battle for the hearts and minds of the people. Vietnam had within its borders a market-dominant Chinese minority. Market-dominant minorities in the developing world. In 2003, I coined the term market-dominant minority to describe an ethnic minority that tends, under market conditions, to dominate economically, often to a startling extent, the poor, indigenous majority around them, generating enormous resentment among the majority, who see themselves as the rightful owners of the land under threat from greedy, exploitative outsiders. Market-dominant minorities are pervasive in the developing world. Examples include ethnic Chinese throughout Southeast Asia, Indians in East Africa and parts of the Caribbean, Lebanese in West Africa and parts of the Caribbean, Igbo in Nigeria, Bamileke in Cameroon, Kikuyu in Kenya, whites in South Africa, whites in Zimbabwe, whites in Namibia, Croats in the former Yugoslavia, Jews in post-communist Russia, Parsis and Gujaratis in Mumbai. The list goes on and on. Groups can be market dominant for very different reasons, some completely unrelated to economics, including colonial divide-and-conquer policies or a history of apartheid. If, as was true of whites in South Africa, a minority uses brutal force and the powers of the state to relegate the majority to inferior education and inhuman conditions for more than a century, that minority is likely to be market dominant for reasons having nothing to do with superior entrepreneurialism. On the other hand, to be clear, market dominance does not refer to vague ethnic stereotypes, but rather to actual, starkly disproportionate control of major sectors of the economy. In Indonesia, Vietnam's neighbor, the Chinese comprise just 3% of the population, but control as much as 70% of the private economy, including virtually all of the country's largest conglomerates. For most of Bolivia's history, a tiny minority of light-skinned, Europeanized elites controlled almost all of the nation's wealth, while the indigenous majority lived in abject poverty. In the Philippines, the 2% Chinese minority controls the country's corporate, banking, airline, shipping, and retail sectors. According to Forbes, in 2015, the top four wealthiest people in the Philippines, and 10 out of the top 15, were ethnic Chinese. Market-dominant minorities are one of the most potent catalysts of political tribalism. When a developing country with an impoverished majority has a market-dominant minority, predictable results follow. Intense ethnic resentment is almost invariable, leading frequently to confiscation of the minority's assets, looting, rioting, violence, and, all too often, ethnic cleansing. In these conditions, the pursuit of free market policies makes things worse. It increases the minority's wealth, provoking still more resentment, more violence, and, typically, populist anger at the regime pursuing such policies. All this held true in Vietnam. Vietnam's Chinese minority. The Chinese in Vietnam, called the Hua, have been market-dominant for centuries, historically controlling the country's most lucrative commercial, trade, and industrial sectors. Resentment against their success, coupled with repeated Chinese invasions, sparked recurrent anti-Hua reprisals, including the 1782 massacre in Cholon, Saigon's sister city, often called Saigon's Chinatown, in which an estimated 10,000 Chinese were slaughtered. According to official Vietnamese records, Chinese shops were burned and looted, and the victims, including men, women, and children, were indiscriminately killed and their corpses thrown into the river. For more than 1 month, No one dared to eat shrimp or to drink water taken from that river. When the French arrived in the 19th century, they shrewdly cultivated Chinese entrepreneurship, in typical colonial divide-and-rule fashion, and welcomed Chinese immigrants. Under French colonial rule, the Hua population rose from 25,000 in the 1860s to more than 200,000 in 1911. By the 1950s, the Hua had amassed such vast economic power and political influence, they were viewed as a state within a state. Chinese magnates, almost all located in southern Vietnam, were known as kings. The petrol king, the oil king, the rice king, the scrap metals king, and so on. The extent of Hua economic dominance is hard to overstate. While the Vietnamese elite filled the ranks of the civil service, colleges, the military, and the professions, the Chinese had a stranglehold on Vietnam's business and commerce. Although still only a tiny percentage of the population, the Chinese controlled a staggering 80% of South Vietnam's industry. The Hua also dominated Vietnam's retail trade, its financial and transportation sectors, and all aspects of the rice economy. On top of that, they were disproportionately represented in the services sector. As of the mid-20th century, they owned more than 50% of all large hotels and 90% of small hotels in the Saigon area, in addition to 92 large restaurants, 243 tea and beer shops, and 826 eating houses. According to one estimate, the Chinese in Vietnam controlled 90% of non-European private capital. Not only did Hua wealth inflame local resentment, their attitude added fuel to the fire. The Hua tended to live apart from the Vietnamese, often in wealthy enclaves, attending their own schools and temples, typically marrying only among other Chinese, and projecting a sense of ethnic and cultural exclusivism. Rightly or wrongly, the Hua were seen as exploiting the native Vietnamese, the vast majority of whom were impoverished peasants. When the Vietnamese went to war against the French, the Chinese minority stayed apolitical, infuriating the Vietnamese. It does not appear that America knew anything about these ethnic realities when we went to war. Or, if we did, it certainly wasn't reflected in our policies. The American Intervention. In 1954, the Vietnamese defeated the French after 8 years of war. Under the U.S.-backed Geneva Accords, Vietnam was divided in two, with Ho's Communist Democratic Republic of Vietnam, DRV, government ruling the north from Hanoi, and the America-backed Republic of Vietnam, ROV, ruling the south from Saigon. The Geneva Accords gave all Vietnamese people 300 days to move freely to their zone of choice, while only about 120,000 moved from south to north, some 800,000 moved in the other direction. Cold warrior Americans no doubt saw the Vietnamese as voting with their feet for capitalism, but a more group-conscious lens reveals a very different picture. Many of those migrating south were Chinese. The vast majority of Chinese in the north relocated, and most of the ethnic Vietnamese who went south were Catholics, including the Frenchified Vietnamese elite, who feared communist persecution. By the end of the relocation period, the overwhelming majority of the Hua, about 1 million out of 1.2 million, lived in South Vietnam. Ho was a passionate believer in the idea of a unified Vietnamese tribe. "We have the same ancestors. We are of the same family. We are all brothers and sisters," he once declared. "No one can divide the children of the same family. Likewise, no one can divide Vietnam." In 1959, Ho committed North Vietnamese forces to liberating the South. The United States responded with escalating military involvement. In 1965, we began sending thousands of troops. We fought in Vietnam for a decade, and we lost. We weren't prepared for and didn't adjust to guerrilla warfare. We backed the wrong leaders. Some argue that we could have won had we only sent more troops. But one of the most important reasons for our devastating defeat remains largely unrecognized. Most of Vietnam's capitalists were not Vietnamese. On the contrary, capitalism in Vietnam was associated with, and seen as chiefly benefiting, the Chinese, a fact that Hanoi repeatedly played up. Although there were also wealthy Vietnamese in the commercial class, Hanoi exaggerated the extent of Chinese dominance, claiming, for example, that the ethnic Chinese controlled 100% of South Vietnam's domestic wholesale trade, and at one point, even calling the largely Chinese city of Shalon the capitalist heart beating within socialist Vietnam's body. Our wartime policies intensified the wealth and power of the already resented Hoa. America poured more than $100 billion into the war effort, and insofar as this money reached the local population, it ended up wildly disproportionately in the pockets of the ethnic Chinese. Americans required enormous amounts of supplies and services, and the Chinese were in the best position to deliver. The Chinese handled more than 60% of the total volume of goods imported into South Vietnam through U.S. aid. Many Chinese made fortunes as middlemen. Of the direct and indirect importers in Vietnam, 84% were ethnic Chinese in 1971. In addition, a flourishing black market, controlled almost exclusively by the Chinese, provided GIs with gold watches, diamonds, cars, minks, marijuana, opium, heroin, and prostitutes. In 1966, Shalon's red light districts employed roughly 30,000 war-orphaned prostitutes, and one out of every four GIs had venereal disease. It wasn't just American dollars enriching Vietnam's Chinese minority. It was capitalism itself. In the financial sector, by 1972, the local Chinese effectively owned 28 of the 32 banks in South Vietnam, although many of these banks were nominally owned by Vietnamese. Moreover, with economic power comes the ability to buy political influence, and the Chinese in Saigon notoriously cultivated and bribed South Vietnamese politicians and military leaders. The slime of corruption oozed into every crevice of wartime South Vietnam. The Chinese not only profited from America's intervention, they seemed ruthlessly impervious to the suffering of the Vietnamese around them. At one point, Chinese rice moguls intentionally created a rice shortage to jack up prices, compounding the hunger and malnourishment already caused by the war. They hoarded rice and even tried to throw it in the river to avoid government searches. Worse still, the Chinese systematically avoided the draft through bribery. Being police chief of the Shalon precinct became one of the most lucrative positions in the country. Ultimately, more than 100,000 Chinese in Shalon dodged the draft. In effect, the U.S.-backed regime was asking the South Vietnamese to fight and die and kill their northern brethren in order to keep the Chinese rich. We completely missed this ethnic dimension. Most American military personnel on the ground in Vietnam couldn't tell the difference between Chinese and Vietnamese. They may not even have been aware there was a difference. All Asians were dinks and gooks, slants and slopes. As one American in Vietnam put it, "We didn't even think they were human. It was gooks don't bleed, gooks don't feel pain, gooks don't have any sense of loyalty or love." From Washington's point of view, we were battling the evil of communism, sacrificing American soldiers for Vietnam's freedom. But from the Vietnamese point of view, the idea that America was offering them freedom was absurd. Their experience of the American intervention was the destruction of their way of life. U.S. firepower destroyed the homes of more than 2 million South Vietnamese, most of whom were forced to relocate to urban areas, leaving behind their ancestors' graves. In addition, they endured indiscriminate bombing, napalm, and horrific civilian deaths. In South Vietnam, a staggering 1 million civilians died, and another million were wounded, mostly from U.S. friendly fire. And for what? The group identity America offered the Vietnamese was membership in a puppet state, the ultimate affront in a country where many Vietnamese soldiers wore trinkets dedicated to the Trung sisters, symbolizing resistance to foreign invaders at all costs. Henry Kissinger saw this as early as 1969, when he warned that, "Unfortunately, our military strength has no political corollary. We have been unable so far to create a political structure that could survive military opposition from Hanoi after we withdraw." As Gunter Levy wrote in 1978, "The South Vietnamese soldier, in the end, did not feel he was part of a political community worth the supreme sacrifice. He saw no reason to die for the U.S.-backed regime." Materially, apart from a tiny upper crust, the Vietnamese people received no benefits from America. On the contrary, they lost their sons and their homes, and the only people they saw profiting were the hated Chinese and corrupt politicians. And yet, as the war progressed and more South Vietnamese went over to the other side, U.S. foreign policymakers were baffled. They couldn't fathom why the Vietnamese hated us so much and didn't want their freedom. If we'd understood Vietnam's history and its ethnic realities, we wouldn't have been so mystified. From a tribal politics perspective, virtually every step we took in Vietnam was guaranteed to turn the Vietnamese against us. The regimes we supported, the policies we promoted, the money we spent, and the attitudes we brought made the Vietnamese hate us, hate capitalism, and only enhanced the appeal and status of the charismatic Ho Chi Minh. The aftermath. Ethnic cleansing. The last U.S. troops left Saigon in 1973. And after that, Americans tried to forget Vietnam. But it was then that the ethno-nationalist dimension of the war became most glaringly clear. In September 1975, the new socialist government launched an anti-capitalist campaign under the codename X1. Chinese businesses were raided or shut down, and 250 wealthy Chinese were arrested. Many Chinese tycoons fled overseas. A number committed suicide. Chinese language newspapers and Chinese-run schools were closed, and Chinese hospitals were taken over by the state. Although wealthy Vietnamese were also targeted, the Hoa suffered the most by far. 70% of those officially condemned in the campaign against comprador bourgeoisie were ethnic Chinese. All told, the Chinese in South Vietnam lost an estimated $2 billion because of the nationalization of their assets in the late 1970s, an astounding sum considering Vietnam's overall poverty at the time. Anti-Chinese sentiment worsened as relations between China and Vietnam deteriorated. In 1977, the campaign against all ethnic Chinese in Vietnam was stepped up and became nationwide in scope. In the South, the Chinese were physically harassed, their homes and property seized. In the North, All working Chinese were placed under surveillance and prohibited from speaking Chinese, even though most of the relatively few Chinese who remained in the North were not wealthy capitalists, but fishermen, foresters, craftsmen, and laborers. In the provinces abutting China, Hanoi began purifying the border areas, expelling the Chinese for alleged security reasons. But the real ethnic cleansing policies began under X2, a second anti-capitalist campaign launched in early 1978. On March 23rd, a paramilitary force of 30,000 cordoned off Shalon, the Chinese area of Saigon, and ransacked every house and shop there. Goods and valuables were confiscated from 50,000 Chinese businesses, and clashes between the Chinese and the police left the streets of Shalon full of corpses. Similar raids took place all over the country, and ethnic Chinese were purged from the party, government administration, and the army. The government began arresting and relocating Chinese at alarming rates. Thousands of Chinese either died laboring in Vietnam's new economic zones or fled the country. Even Chinese in the North who had been loyal revolutionaries were arrested as spies. My uncle was arrested at that time, one Vietnamese Chinese later recalled. He had been working for the revolution, at least 40 years. He had been awarded the first rank revolution medal by the Vietnamese communists themselves. Employing techniques Hitler used to inflame hatred against the Jews, reported U.S. News and World Report in 1979, Hanoi is blaming day-to-day problems in Vietnam on resented Chinese control of commerce and the Mekong Delta. Beijing accused Hanoi of mass killings and atrocities committed against the ethnic Chinese. Although long denied by Vietnam, experts agree that China's allegations have now been largely substantiated. By late 1978, more than 250,000 ethnic Chinese had been driven out of Vietnam, and an estimated 30,000 to 40,000 had died at sea. Americans heard in the late 1970s a great deal about Vietnamese boat people. Rarely, if ever, was it reported that most of those refugees were in fact ethnic Chinese. In 1978, for example, 85% were Chinese. In 1979, Vietnamese foreign ministry officials effectively admitted to foreign journalists that Vietnam intended to get rid of all Chinese in Vietnam. Since the Vietnam War, there have been three main waves of Vietnamese refugees. A first wave left Vietnam in 1975, immediately after Saigon fell. The second wave occurred in 1978 to 79, around the time that Vietnam and China went to war. Approximately 70% of the refugees in these two waves were ethnic Chinese, most of whom eventually resettled in the West. In 1988 to 89, a third wave of refugees left Vietnam. This group was primarily ethnic Vietnamese. Thus, Vietnam's communist revolution was not only nationalist, but intensely ethno-nationalist. We completely missed the heart of Vietnamese political tribalism. Far from being a pawn of communist China, as the United States imagined, Vietnam would by 1979 be at war with China. It would be difficult to come up with a more effective strategy for shooting ourselves in the foot, undermining our own objectives, and maximizing popular resistance against us. Chapter 3. Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, you don't understand yourself solely as an individual. You understand yourself as a son, a brother, a cousin to somebody, an uncle to somebody. You are part of something bigger than yourself. Khaled Hosseini. May God keep you away from the venom of the cobra, the teeth of the tiger, and the revenge of the Afghans. Proverb. For most Americans, Afghanistan is a black box. We know that our soldiers have died there, that there are mullahs and caves, and that both may have harbored Osama bin Laden. We're vaguely aware that the war we're fighting in Afghanistan is the longest in our history. We've all heard of the Taliban, an organization that destroys art and bans girls from school and that wears black or possibly white. Our dim memory is that we beat them once, but now, for some reason, they are back, and we have no idea what's going on, and we just want to forget about the whole country. Yet we keep hearing ominous warnings from people in the know that things are going badly there and are likely to get worse, that Afghanistan is a foreign policy disaster, a never-ending war. Or, as one congressman recently wrote in the National Interest, 15 years, thousands of lives, and tens of billions of dollars later, the United States has failed to meet most of its key objectives in Afghanistan. Mission failed. As in Vietnam, the core reason for America's failures in Afghanistan is that we were oblivious to the most important group identities in the region, which do not fall along national lines, but instead are ethnic, tribal, and clan-based. Afghanistan's national anthem mentions 14 ethnic groups, the largest four being the Pashtuns, Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Hazaras. There is a long history of animosity among these groups. For more than 200 years, the Pashtuns dominated Afghanistan, but during the Cold War, their dominance began to decline, and in 1992, a Tajik and Uzbek-led coalition seized control. The Taliban, supported by Pakistan, emerged against this background. The Taliban is not only an Islamist movement, but also an ethnic movement. The vast majority of its members are Pashtuns. It was founded by Pashtuns, it is led by Pashtuns, and it arose out of, and derives its staying power because of, threats to Pashtun dominance. American leaders and policymakers entirely missed these ethnic realities, and the results have been calamitous. Our blindness to tribal politics allowed Pakistan to play us badly, turned large numbers of Afghans against us, and led us inadvertently to help create the Taliban, arming, funding, and training many of its key figures. The problem in Afghanistan is not just radical Islam. It's also an ethnic problem, and it's rooted in a cardinal rule of tribal politics. Once in power, groups do not give up their dominance easily. Afghanistan and Pakistan. Afghanistan is landlocked. It shares its western border with Iran. Indeed, Afghanistan's Tajiks speak Dari Persian and are often described as Eastern Iranians. To its north lie the former Soviet Central Asian republics of Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. To its east and southeast sits Pakistan, with which it shares a 1,500-mile-long border, known as the Durand Line. The state of Afghanistan was established in 1747 by a Pashtun, the celebrated king Ahmad Shah Durrani. From 1747 to 1973, Pashtun leaders ruled Afghanistan almost continuously. Pashtuns pride themselves on being great warriors. Europeans never conquered Afghanistan, although the British and Russians certainly tried. Pashto is the mother tongue of the Pashtuns, who also have their own code of conduct, known as Pashtunwali, which is difficult to translate into Western terms, but roughly includes honor, hospitality, reciprocity, and revenge among its key components. Many Pashtuns think of Afghanistan as their country, and even today, the terms Afghan and Pashtun are often used interchangeably. But Pashtuns don't live only in Afghanistan. They also live in Pakistan. Indeed, the name Pakistan is an acronym invented in Cambridge, England, in